I'm here today to tell you how the Global Fund should be moving forward. Please feel free to heckle me. We're getting very used to that. And at the end of the presentation, if you feel you want to go and occupy the Global Fund, just take a few tents from nearby. I'm very grateful for my colleagues in the Global Fund, Anirita Bain, Senior Advisor to the Executive Director, Professor Michelle Kazachkin, and for Sinead Ryan, Senior Program Officer in my unit, for helping me with a lot of the background and inputs on this. Very grateful for Jean's very nice introduction, for Anne's great lead on this subject, and for Koki's fantastic analysis of where some of the problems lie, even if we all decide to move forward. I'll try to go a bit quickly, and first I'd like to talk about the Global Fund, who we are, what we stand for, how we're structured and governed, just briefly, because I think some of you, could you just show me with a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with the Global Fund, just as a general organization? Okay, so I'll go a bit quickly over that without missing some key points. And then how we operate, then some of the scope and the results to date, and I'll be happy to give some specific country examples. Well, some of the factors behind our success could also be something we could think about. All of them are self-perceived factors. Nobody actually told us this is what they think about us. MNCH in the Global Fund's current portfolio and funding work. And then I'm going to finish hopefully with a positive note on the Global Fund's potential to further help address the needs of mothers and girls and children. This is our framework document. It's basically our Bible, and we are really a financing mechanism represented by a multi-stakeholder public-private partnership. I'll come later to the composition of our board. We were created about 10 years ago by COF at a launched in a call to establish a war chest for three diseases. Initially it was just one, but then people added another two to diseases that were identified as diseases of inequity and that were at that time underfinanced and globally and in various countries. We're also established as part of the movement towards the MDGs. These are some of our principles. We're a financial instrument. We make available and leverage additional funding resources, a principle you will hear called additionality. Supporting programs that reflect national ownership, a very key principle, and beautiful as it is, also part of the problems we've faced in trying to get the Global Fund to actually take a little more of a proactive role in its own future and destiny, because people always say, oh, that's country ownership. And I suspected that they have little statue of country ownership to which they supplicate every morning. We operate, hopefully, in a balanced manner. We actually have that proven in terms of, not that we had the foresight to do it, but in analyzing retrospectively where we've invested, we found a reasonable balance across the three diseases and across the geographic regions of the world. We only deal, by the way, with we do not invest in the G8 or in the G20, but all other countries, depending on what nature of needs they have, we can invest in them. We pursue, hopefully, an integrated and balanced approach to prevention, treatment, and care, and we haven't gotten that formula right. We evaluate proposals through an independent review process, and I'll come later on as to a little description of how that works. Establish a simplified, rapid, and innovative grant-making process, and as somebody mentioned earlier, and also that we should operate transparently and accountably. And that we should make use of existing international mechanisms and health plans. That's very important to today's discussion. We also focus on performance, and I'll talk a little bit about the performance-based funding model that we have. This is our partnership approach, and we have the country coordinating mechanisms, which henceforth you'll hear me refer to as CCMs. The public sector in our board is about 20 people who are voting, and then another 7 entities who do not vote, including the board chair, the vice chair, the executive director, a range of UN and other partners. But basically we have 10 implementing block groups, and these are governments from the implementing countries, ministers essentially. And we have 3 seats in our board for civil society, from the north and from the south, and for communities of people living with the disease. We have technical agencies that you see there, and we have the private sector represented by both the corporate and commercial private sector, as well as the non-profit private foundations like Gates, which plays a very active role in the creation and the support to the Global Fund. This is also reflected, by the way, in our country coordinating mechanisms. A brief overview of how we're governed, basically, is that we have the technical review panel that receives the proposals from countries and essentially makes recommendations. And we've gradually tried to improve how it is composed, because these are people whom we lock up in a nice hotel on Lake Geneva or Lake Leman to review the proposals when they come in after each round of funding. But the connectivity to the countries and the relevance to the countries is sometimes very important to review a proposal. But there are experts, and it's, we're very happy that they're increasingly becoming multidisciplinary. We have sociologists, we have legal experts, we have activists, we have, of course, biomedical scientists, and so on. Our board is the Supreme Governance Body. It's got 26 members and meets twice a year. Our next board meeting that will approve our next five-year strategy will happen in just 3 weeks from now. We're very thrilled at that because of some of the early indications of good news that Anne and Koki had mentioned. We have an advisory partnership forum, which this year in June met in Sao Paulo, Brazil. And this is like our parliament, as Michel Kazatchkin likes to call it. It doesn't actually have a decision-making role, but it actually has very strong recommendations. The Global Fund adopted a gender policy and a policy towards sexual minorities and so on after the partnership forum said that it has to in Durban. And this year, the partnership forum talked very strongly about looking more intelligently at maternal, neonatal, and child health and how the Global Fund should do it. So I think we're riding on that wave of very strong support from our governance bodies. In our secretariat, which is where I work in Geneva, we don't have any country offices, and we basically manage the day-to-day operations of the fund. We actually do not allocate funding. The funding is allocated by the TRP based on the technical merit of proposals, and the board then approves those recommendations. These are the country coordinating mechanisms, and they basically initiate and coordinate and decide whether or not that country, and when we say country, we mean all the partners in the country, multidisciplinary, multi-stakeholder, NGOs. People like to say that we're the first, but I don't think we are the first, but we're amongst the first, who have brought in communities and consumer groups affected by the disease, private sector, the media, some parliamentarians, sitting alongside governments and having an equal vote in those CCMs, for which we have rules of how they should operate. But that's where actually the idea of whether or not to apply for funding originates. And this is very relevant to what I'm going to be saying later, either before or after you occupy Geneva. They submit the proposals to the Global Fund based on what they see as priority needs, so there's a lot of room for work there. Once the proposals go through the board and the TRP, the technical review panel, the CCM then decides to nominate who's the principal recipient of the money. And the contract is done between the secretariat and the principal recipient. And then there's the oversight role down there that we're trying to improve based on some analysis recently of risk and fiduciary control in the Global Fund, which has not been as innovative, I think, in my view, as the basic idea and the principles in the Global Fund. And then we also try to, the CCM should ensure, as Koki was mentioning, linkages and consistency of the Global Fund grants and the national health and development context within which they should be situated. And I say should be because in most of the time they are not. We have found that 60% of our funding is not recorded on the Ministry of Finance budgets in the 150 countries. And that's unacceptable for all the principles I was mentioning earlier. So we think ourselves, the board, and the CCM should do more work to make sure that although it was designed originally and deliberately as a vertical financing mechanism for the three diseases, there's no reason why in the way that it comes into the country, the way that it operates, that it cannot be integrated into the national health sector response that includes all the actors. And finally, the CCM approves also any reprogramming and submits requests for continued funding, and that's also a part of its day-to-day role in the countries. Performance-based funding was referred to. This is one of the key principles of how we operate, and this is the how the description goes. I'll be very happy to go into the details later because I want to get to the very important parts of the presentation. But I think many of you are aware of how performance-based funding goes. It's based on targets, usually service delivery coverage targets that are stated in the proposal, and we release tranches of money based on a certain kind of verification that these targets, that previous targets had actually been achieved. This matters a lot in grant negotiations in terms of what are the indicators, the legal contract that we establish. It also matters when it comes to grant renewal. It also matters when it comes to reprogramming, which is again another aspect that I'll come to in a minute. One snapshot of the scope of where we work and some of the results we've, I'd like to say pushed from my injecting drug using days in Russia, but we've pushed $22.4 billion into the three diseases. Today the market share for international segment of funding for malaria is that 80 cents of every dollar is funded by the, it comes through the global fund. It's funded by the taxpayers and the private sector donors who support the global fund, but it comes through the global fund. And of those that we have signed, it's 18.5 billion due to a large number of reasons that there's a discrepancy between the two. We like to say that it's not us, it's the countries that are not giving us the right things to enable us to sign, but we have a very, very bad disbursement rate. And our disbursement rate at the moment is 14 billion. These are some of the results we like to brag about, I guess. And I've intentionally mentioned some of those that hopefully you will see a relevance to the maternal, neonatal, and child health. This is an example from Zambia, and depending on the rigor of attribution, what we have seen is that there is a decline in child mortality rates between 2001 and 2008. We picked those years because these are the years just before the start of the Global Fund and well into the Global Fund when it started really providing a lot of money. I think we can take partial credit for that, and that's the fair way to put it. We should not and should not be claiming all the credit for it like some of my very ambitious colleagues like to say. And we've been warned about that in the recent high-level panel report about making impact and making sure we attribute things well. We also like to say that these results are not of our own making. Really, as a financing mechanism, with about 600 people sitting in Geneva, the Global Fund doesn't do the actual work. In fact, even the banking part is the World Bank is our purse, our trustee. This work and these results have been achieved by people like yourselves, by other people like the ones mentioned by the previous speakers, by governments, civil society groups, community-based groups, faith-based groups, research and teaching institutions, technical partners, and other donors who've contributed significantly to what's happening to these results. And it's very important to recognize and attribute that effort to these partners. The we part has been heard too much in the Global Fund, and I'm starting a little campaign just before you occupy the Global Fund to try to change that. We think these are some of the reasons. I mean, the scale is definitely, I think, it's clear that this scale of funding for these particular three diseases hasn't come. You pump that much money into any disease and you're likely to get some really good results. The model of promoting country ownership, well, and that's a good one. It's made sure that we've learned that lesson from maybe 50, 100 years of international development and put the onus on the countries to define what it is they want funding for. But in a recent high-level panel report, which I might as well start waving now, which is this one, it's recommended reading for you, but it's required reading for all of us in the Secretariat these days, has said that country ownership cannot be an excuse for just sending out the money and not caring about it. We need to guide, support countries, and we need to make fiduciary control a bit more rationalized. So we're supporting country ownership by taking a little more of a proactive role from now onwards. Result and performance-based, that's again, I think that's important. It's not unique to the Global Fund. There are governments and countries that actually use it and other financing mechanisms. And the fact that we're financing only evidence-based interventions. And on that, we rely on groups of experts like yourselves, international research institutions. And we would like to see when we come to the discussion of MNCH that we start moving beyond our almost singular reliance on WHO and UNAIDS as the sources of normative standards and evidence. I believe, having worked with WHO, but also with many others, that, for example, in WHO, treatment adherence for HIV/AIDS and for ART was actually developed by activist groups and NGOs working with experts and practitioners, and WHO adopted those. And so it's very important to also expand where we get that evidence from. I also heard yesterday from Jean that the MNCH world has been working on the evidence, maybe because of the funding lag, but also because it's an older movement. And that's what we need to bring into where we are in the Global Fund. And then we say the inclusiveness. Again, we're very proud that we're working with various groups. There was a representative of the communities in a recent board meeting, and one of the ministers said, we'd like to host the next board meeting in our country. I'm not going to mention which country, but she looked at him, was sitting next to her, and she said, Your Excellency, you know we have a policy that we don't have our board meetings in countries that have travel and work and visa restrictions related to HIV status. He kept on insisting, and she essentially, by the end of the session, shut him up, even though he put up a CD advertising his capital. That's how strong and equitable the distribution of power is in our board. Governance, board, and the CCMs. In the CCMs, we have a similar model. We haven't yet gotten, because we have struggles by NGOs to gain access to what has largely been a body dominated by ministries of health. We're trying to change that now in the new reforms and the new strategy. And then the inclusiveness also is that it's the finance, and we're looking at various innovative ways to go beyond just taxpayers' money from the major rich G8 or G20 countries into some interesting, neat ideas we do with the private sector but that need to come up to scale, and getting into issues like debt to health, where one country writes off part of the debt as part of its share to leverage the Global Fund investment. We've also started things like what UNITAID and UNICEF have been doing for a long time. We call them innovations, but they've been around for a long time, like getting a small cut from stocks that are traded and shares that are traded in the London Stock Exchange, and some countries are looking at cuts from other kinds of financial transactions. I think this has been said much more eloquently by both by Jean, Anne, and Koki, but these are also, to make sure that you realize we do get it, is that we actually think that there are real good reasons. It's the same burden, it's the same fight, and I just give you the self-explanatory statistics that we've been able to cull from some of the literature. And this literature actually was produced by you, by activists and researchers like yourselves. And I think that looking at it, as Anne was mentioning in her description, that you know we're looking at it from both ways, it makes a lot of sense for us to do this. Now, unfortunately, this kind of slide was used by some of the antagonists in our governance structures to say, well, since we're already doing a lot for MNCH, you shouldn't be doing more. Yeah, you see how politics works. And what we should be saying is, these are, in the way that both Anne and Koki mentioned, these are now excellent opportunities to do more. We're not talking about a different kind of woman from another planet. It's the same woman. It's the same girl. It's the same infant. This is too crowded a slide, but I think also Anne had mentioned a certain version of it. This is almost the laundry list of what we have found are things we currently do or could do, even within our current mandate, that up until this November board in Ghana hasn't yet permitted us to go a bit further on MNCH. So it's a bit extensive just by the size, by the fact that the site itself is crowded. We're already doing these things. I'll come to some specific country examples. And, of course, this presentation will be uploaded on the website. You'll be able to look at it and refer to it in the research. But we just went in and brought some researchers to look at our current portfolio. And we found that this is some of the stuff we're already doing, most of it. And some of the stuff we can do even within our current mandate is added to that. We have a direct relevance. People like to talk about MDG 6, which is our core mandate, the three diseases. MDGs 4 and 5, but I also like to say that for MDGs 1 on poverty and hunger, MDGs 2 when we provide HIV services and the means of improved livelihood for women and girls, we enable them to attend school. We are also addressing gender in a number of ways, gender equality, and that by virtue of our model, what we were promoting is global partnerships that make sense. The challenge now is to move on MDG 8, which is what my unit tries to advocate for as a partnership unit. The Global Fund contributions to MDGs 4 and 5, this is, again, some of the stuff we used to say, yeah, we are doing something for MDGs 4 and 5, for mothers, children, and neonates. And based on the previous slide I showed, we've looked at some of the costs, and we have calculated how much of it has benefited the health of women and children. But we also hope, at least I hope, that we would not use that to be complacent and say, all right, we're doing enough now, let's not feel guilty about it, and just let's move on. We should be looking at it more intelligently, as a previous speaker said, and we should work to deliberately try to address it because it has a mutual synergy with what we're trying to do. I've worked in Ethiopia, and I found that there is no way a country like Ethiopia can bring up PMTCT coverage, one of our key indicators and one of the key MDG indicators, without addressing head-on the issue of skilled birth attendance in Ethiopia. And they, you know, some people in the government and other partners said, well, it must be cultural factors to go and bring the women. Well, the surveys showed us that women don't come because we're not investing in the facilities, in the health workers, equipping them, training them, and improving their attitude. And we just got into a plateau of our PMTCT coverage rate. Very embarrassing. And I think the reality is the same in many countries in resource-poor settings. And so these are some of the things that, in a less altruistic way, we use to convince people in the board of the Global Fund that, hey, on your own terms, you're not going to be able to achieve your goals unless you branch out and start working more intelligently. Examples that I promised to share, Ethiopia, one of my favorite examples, and strengthening human resources. So Ethiopia built one quarter of its massive number of health centers. It's the second most populous country in Africa, after the Egyptians toned down their numbers, after Nigeria. And it has built one quarter of its health centers, 14 of its 16 blood banks, using Global Fund money. And they didn't ask permission for it. We said country ownership, they took us on it. Another country built a set of midwifery and nursing schools using Global Fund money. If you don't have nurses to deliver the services in some of the decentralized primary health care services, service delivery points, how are you going to be doing any services related to HIV, TB, and malaria? That's the kind of intelligent work that I'm not going to say we arrived at these things, because in the Secretariat we don't tell countries what to write in a proposal. This is the energy, the wisdom, and the foresight of the country actors and partners that sit in the CCM and around it. So we have to give them credit for even making those baby steps in support of MNCH. Cambodia has this example here where we finance the training of village volunteers to provide contraception, birth spacing, and other family planning services, and to improve the utilization of maternal care services and providing birth preparedness counseling. All of it justified based on the fact that the HIV indicators or the TB or the malaria ones would not improve unless you do that. Nigeria has also strengthened some primary healthcare facilities by providing family planning and these lists of services that you see there. And also in Papua New Guinea, we've funded and financed, and also in Ethiopia, we financed IMCI, IMPAC, the Global Fund had financed when I was in WHO in Ethiopia, IMCI, IMPAC, and IMI approaches, which, as you know, address a wide range of diseases, not just HIV, TB, and malaria. Anne, I think, had a very nice set of full decision points. What I can say that is in 2010, we've had board decisions that have guided us in this way to address. And you can see the tentativeness, encourage countries. Coming from maybe some of the exacting science that WHO uses, I was a bit baffled by the terminology culture in the Global Fund. We had a major report, and the reform report, and the board came up with a decision point saying they embraced the report. I searched all over for the word approve, endorse, please go ahead. And I said, what, we're just going to hug it? Yeah. So none of us, I think neither Anne, Koki, or myself, would like the word encouraging countries. We need to be a bit more stronger. And this is where some of the stuff that came under the encouragement has already started. We started looking at low PMTCT coverage rates, and we started asking countries to reprogram some of the money they already had into things that would help address that through improving aspects and interfaces and parts of the patient care continuum related to MNCH. And this is the list of countries, a small amount, frankly, compared to 20 billion, but it's a start. We started then, based on that encouraging word, we started then developing some guidelines, and I think Anne and Koki were mentioning them, and they had good recommendations about how we should all be engaged in this, into getting all the partners, the UN partners, the NGOs, the experts, the research institutions, to say, right, if the word is encouraging, if it's basically please make use of existing resources in supporting maternal, neonatal, and child health, how then would that translate at the country level? And I think Koki was mentioning some difficulties in the malaria in terms of normative guidelines and so on. So even when you get over the policy hurdle and the financing hurdle, and some everybody says, yes, we're really excited, you have some significant challenges in the countries to get the reading of the country context right, even by the country actors themselves, and to actually be able to go down then to the service delivery level, depending on the kind of service delivery organization, and to actually begin seeing that integration. Integration is probably one of the longest talked good things that has seen very little actual results, and sometimes some backfiring. These are some of the indicative MNCH interventions. We've developed the strategic performance and evaluation cluster to say these are some of the ways that we already feel we're doing and we will continue doing, being encouraged. Well, as long as we've not been slapped on the wrist. The word encourage cannot be interpreted in that way. So these are the kinds of interventions, specific interventions of malaria, TB, and HIV that we will continue supporting. And regardless, by the way, so that even in the November board, if, you know, heaven forbid, if we get a big resounding no to the maternal, neonatal, and child health pillar of our next five-year strategy, these are things we will continue doing them. So I hope when you hear the news on our website about what the board has decided in November and you hear that the MNCH has been chucked out, I hope you do not feel too disparaged. There's still a lot we can work on to improve how we engage and strengthen maternal units and child health. Some of these are some of the tips which, as Koki mentioned, for the country-level actors and the their global supporters here in Washington and elsewhere who are looking at, okay, right, how, you know, what's the next step? Well, we have rounds every year, and the round 11 is our 11th round for funding. It's been opened on 15th of August. Countries began preparing it, and then we looked in our pocket and we found that we don't have enough money for it, so we postponed it a little bit. This is all putting it very gently and kindly. Some heads are about to roll on that. But basically, when and if, so there's now a window up until March, 1st of March, for countries to put together their proposal as opposed to December. This is an opportunity for us because what we are looking at is a November strong policy mandate that improves the MNCH pillar of our strategy. We already have stuff I'd mentioned a little while ago on this slide where we can already move even if that is not approved. And we now have some time and a real funding opportunity for all of us to engage with our partners and ourselves in the, at the country level and start making sure we have these features that when you look at the proposals that are being developed, you put them to test through this filter. And it needs to demonstrate relevance to our key ATM mandate, and you can be very creative about that, as I mentioned earlier, with the Ethiopian blood banks and the nursing schools and midwifery schools. Looking at operational research as well is also accepted. We do not fund basic research in the Global Fund. We're prevented from doing that by mandate. But operational research that can help configure the hows and the what is also acceptable. Technical strength in MNCH and other proposed interventions by the entity that is submitting that proposal. So there needs to be competence, institutional and otherwise. Financial strength and realistic costing and budget consistencies, you know, just to make it plausible for the TRP to look at it at this stage of our branching out to MNCH. And then to make sure that when you consider in the proposal either confirming the demonstrated implementation capacity for that, but also the Global Fund provides funding to build the capacity, that capacity. But being cognizant of it in the proposal up front is very important for increasing the chances of success. And then looking at how the current request complements or builds on previous proposals, so you don't have one round on this and another round on something completely different with no synergies between them. These are just some features. There are many other features, including the actual format and how to write good language and things like that. Our proposal guidelines, by the way, usually issued, and for round 11 they've been issued a while ago. We've now been given the good news, even in the 26th of September board meeting that looked at this blue report, that proposal development would no longer be, it used to be, I really don't know where we've learned calling ourselves an innovative mechanism, to just ask countries to write voluminous proposals and then just go to them with a yes or a no after two missives coming from the TRP in Geneva saying, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. Well, hallelujah, we've woken up, been told by our board that we'll start a two-stage iterative process for proposal development that we should engage and must engage the widest group of partners. The first stage will be hopefully a simple 3 to 5 page concept note that the TRP will look at for technical soundness and a basic conceptual approach and with a guaranteed total amount of money with not too many budget details. Once there is a go on that one, that money is locked for that country. Then the country can go through the laborious and sometimes very expensive and time-consuming process of developing the proposal. What used to happen in the past is countries used to front the money themselves, and it cannot be recovered later, for proposals that they didn't know whether they're going to succeed or not. And many of you as technical partners have worked with those proposals. It's so frustrating. It's really frustrating. So we finally woke up to a smarter way of doing that. The TRP feedback for technical review panels feedback for round 11 is the guidance we've given them is to say that Global Fund is flexible, but it's no special pool of funding for MNCH. We do have a special window of funding for most at-risk groups, and that has come up in the last couple of years. We have a special pool of funding separate from the general pool from which we finance the proposals for concentrated epidemics in countries that are upper middle income countries and that satisfy a whole set of composite indicators. And that one has a financial cap to it per proposal and in total. We don't have anything like that for MNCA, so let's keep that in mind. Round 11 can address missed opportunities in areas of MNCH, but activities must be presented in the context of a global fund mandate. And again, this is the whole thing about, please try to realize we're still looking at a tangential influence on MNCH. If the board approves this strategy, we come up with a work plan, say, by mid next year. We start opening that slightly, that wedge in the door a bit further. We can be talking about better things, moving on to what Anne was mentioning earlier, which is the option three, the global, a better coordinated global single fund. And well, I mean, we actually have 5 years to 4 years to the MDG. So, but we really need to move very smartly on this. And then we need to maximize the synergies and the linkages of MNCH to disease-specific, or what I call health and community system initiatives. How can HIV, malaria, and TB, and health system interventions be leveraged to improve MNCH? And R11 is not an opportunity for funding entire MNCH programs. Ethiopia funded its magnesium sulfate, its condoms, its family planning services, antenatal care, speculums, things like that here and there. It succeeded because it shied just short of asking for money to establish an entire maternal health center with a couch and the water supply and the electricity. So there's room. There is room, but it also needs to be looked at in the context of the current overall shrinking financial envelope globally. Looking ahead, and this is the slide that I hope I can leave you with as a positive look into the future to make this particular woman happy. Maximizing the impact of global fund investments on improving the health of mothers and children is now the approved statement from last week's Policy and Strategy Committee of the Global Fund. That's going to go as a draft. It's already been, I think, this week circulated to the board members. By the 23rd of November, please look up the Global Fund website that I'll show you. And I'm really hoping, cross your fingers, or go and occupy Geneva in the meantime, to make sure that it gets approved. And then we will have then to work hard on developing the details of the how. But the whether part, or if, will be over. And what we had as a small explanatory note for that is that we need to work more strategically with partners to increase the uptake of existing flexibilities to maximize MNCH outcomes. Existing flexibilities is code word for the current grants and the stuff we've already been doing that we obviously cannot come back and say, oh, we're not going to do that stuff anymore. But we can't say that. If it worked, if it achieved its objectives, we should be doing it. And then the caveat there, the disclaimer, pending approval by the Global Fund Board in November. Conclusions is that as a key financing mechanism, we're focused on HIV, AIDS, TB, and malaria, but we're already making some investments in MNCH. We think, and I believe strongly, that the five-year strategy will further leverage our investments to enhance our grants' impact on girls, mothers, and children. We need to realize that when everything is set, and the money is there, and the permissions and the policy framework is there, everything starts in the country and finishes in the country. It is your engagement at the country level that's going to make it happen. I mean, in chatting with some of you now, and maybe hopefully after this session, some of the initial work to get that policy to get cleared will happen in capitals of the donor countries, convincing taxpayers that this makes more sense, it's more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. But once that is cleared, and once that little window is opened, our work will have to be in the countries. And in my unit, I'm moving to make sure that my unit focuses 80 to 90% of its time in strengthening country partners, recognizing them, bringing them in, helping COCI with bringing in the maternal and neonatal child experts into CCMs, making sure that even if they're not in CCMs, they sit down there and roll up their sleeves and are allowed to bring in a real substantive input into the proposals and eventually into the management of grants. If we work closer, I think we can bring those mutual synergies to enhance our joint resource mobilizations. Many of the previous speakers have mentioned how useful it is to do this. The evidence base is in a large number of ways shared, or we could achieve and develop that much more efficiently if we work together as two, let's say, two armies in the same battlefield. And the technical expertise often is shared. I started off with, well, some self-claimed expertise in reproductive health and primary health care, and I found myself treating HIV/AIDS patients in Vietnam and elsewhere. So this is part of how we're really not two communities. So let's just bring our energies and wisdom and passion to support the common cause. It's not a duel between two mandates. It's the potential to bring these two armies on the same battlefield that we're hopefully creating by the end of this month to benefit that same mother, the same child, and the same girl. I'm going to leave you with these, and my email is down there in case you want to communicate with me. I may not respond to all of your questions, but I'll certainly refer you to some of my colleagues in the Global Fund who could do that. But please check out these. Definitely make it a point on just before Thanksgiving to go to the Global Fund website on 23rd of November, and hopefully we will be it will be an opportunity for us to thank you for lobbying and for making such a strong case for us to act more intelligently. And thank you for listening.
When I put this panel together, I had a little bit of an idea of what Anne would say, a bit of an idea of what COCI would say. And I know what we've been saying about the Global Fund. I did some research just after the decision point for a paper, and a lot of the issues that came up in today's panel came out. But I really felt that we needed to have somebody from the Global Fund, directly from the Global Fund, on this panel to speak really from their point of view. And I didn't have much luck sending a request. But mobilize the other two panelists. And COCI, thank you so much. She found somebody with a name and started working on her. That was Sarah Churchill. And after a little bit of back and forth, she recommended Akram. And I think you've helped a lot. I don't think we're going to talk about throwing tomatoes at you today, Akram. I think we're talking about
what also serves to protect me.
I think it's pretty obvious that the partnerships, and in the audience there are many people who recommend who either are members of potential partners to help out here or represent networks of potential partners from various levels. And I think it's time, because I'm somebody with feet in both MNCH and malaria and TB, and it's time for the malaria people to get out of their comfort zone, and it's time for the RMCH people to get out of their comfort zone and come talk to the weirdos over in malaria and those sorts of, I mean, what I'm saying is we're now needing to move over to talk to others who, and when you do, you find out you have a lot of common interests. So we can't solve all the problems of the world today, but I would like to give an opportunity for the audience to ask some questions, and then within the international health section, I've already brought it up with the MCH working group to see how we might continue this dialogue. So mark your calendars and get your funding for San Francisco next October, and join APHA so that we can maybe move this conversation there. And also, we belong to different organizations: Global Health Council, the Core Group. And we can try to make opportunities for us to discuss this so that we can help. And one thing I would like to say that Akram mentioned was, and we're going to try to find out a way to get the information on when they're looking for members of that technical review panel to review these actual applications. Did they review the concept papers or only the full proposals?
That's being worked out.
That's being worked out. Okay, well, we'll let you know. But anyway, we want to make sure that you can find each other, because this is a very ripe group who understand those kind of issues. And then maybe perhaps also Ann and Cokie know people that might recommend for those purposes. And so let me get a little bit open, and we'll start out with Doug.
Hi, Doug is super with ideas and also Christian connections for international health. We work a lot with the Christian health associations in Africa, and there seems to be a growing sentiment of a need to fill the gap for women and children, not just the big three diseases. So there's a lot of faith-based initiative that's ready to happen around these topics. And I know from talking with them, they feel often that they aren't a part or don't have much of a voice with CCMs, even though they provide a great portion of the healthcare in many countries. So could you comment on that and maybe give some suggestions for those of us who are working with these groups, how to make that work better in partnership?
Yes.
You bring up an excellent point. Our definition of civil society is really encompassing all nonprofit groups. And the strength of the faith-based is not just that they're just one other group that's rallied around a different cause, but the faith and spirituality element is very strongly associated with a better response to many of the stigma and discrimination issues and the adherence and compliance issues. Just come from a visit in India where the Christian Medical Association in India has actually been doing TB compliance since 1907. I mean, that's before even the treatment came. So that recognition is increasingly coming. It's not for us to be convinced, though, as I mentioned earlier, it is the country coordinating mechanism. We have a minimum requirement of about 40% of the seats of any country coordinating mechanism have to be from civil society. So your coalition that will help you get into the CCM either as a seat holder or as an observer or as a presenter is the NGOs that are actually on the CCM. They're posted on our website by name, phone number, and email. We can give you their home address too. And basically, it's very, very important that you engage locally. Whichever denomination you belong to, we've got some very strong Muslim groups, some very strong Jewish groups, some very strong Buddhist groups, and Hindu and Christian of all denominations. It's very important that you also use the leverage of the church and religious leaders in that country to talk to the people who, in a sense, control the CCM to say, we have something to offer to the three diseases, and we would like to be able to come and at least present what we have can bring. Many of the bed nets, so we already have some strong international faith-based groups, Catholic Relief Services, World Vision, we're also partial donors to the Global Fund. But it's extremely important that we start having a connection on the ground with the local versions of those denominations, and that we get to them to engage. And it's very important that you articulate in what area would you be relevant to that. But articulating that to the CCM, engaging in the proposal development, seeing what you can address from the national needs, stating what you're already addressing from the national needs that doesn't get captured in the background of proposals usually. We just go to the big doors and say, how much are you paying for this, for your current work? We never capture the great work that United Methodists and the others are doing all over the world with church money that just doesn't get tracked. Yeah. And we have a focal point in my unit. Her name is Katia Roll. I'll give you her, the suffix is the same, which is theglobalfund.org, one word. And the first name is Katya, K-A-T-J as in John, and then A again, and then dot, and then role is R-O-L-L. And she is the focal point in my unit, not for the whole secretariat, for working with faith-based groups. She can give you more details of how to take this further.
Hi, Henry Perry from Johns Hopkins, and I want to thank you all for the panel. As I was listening to all this and very excited, I was also very much aware of something that's missing in all this, which I think can be a third army to help make this even more effective, and that's what you mentioned at the very end but didn't get very much lip service to, that's strengthening community health systems. So much of all this work has been facility-based, and we all know in resource-constrained settings that facilities really play a relatively limited role in reaching people, and we know that 95% of all of these interventions can be provided outside of facilities. And so my question is, how much scientific evidence of how these specific interventions can be provided effectively at the community level. But there's a further push for that. And it goes far beyond just embracing the idea of community health. It involves embracing the resources and contributions to communities and working in partnerships with communities, which ministries of health have such a weak reference.
I'm going to jump in just for a second and let Akram either correct me or confirm what I say. Country approaches, country system strengthening is already in the global fund mandate as an approach. So is social mobilization, so is gender. What we discussed over the weekend is getting reviewers that understand that the strengths and the appropriateness of those approaches, as you mentioned, Henry, and I don't know if Akram will back me up or correct me.
Thanks very much, Doctor. I think it's not just reviewers that need to be convinced. Some people inside the Global Fund, some people in the board need to be convinced. So we've got guidelines out there, just like the MNCH one. What's very important is, for example, in the Joint Health System platform, hopefully in the future the Global Fund will move more towards funding national strategy applications as opposed to specific grants by proposal. It's a bit more of a harmonizing tendency and a better aligned. In that one, we had to struggle inside the Secretariat with some of our own colleagues, not to mention board members, to make sure community system strengthening is part of the Joint Health System platform funding, that is part of the national strategy application, that NGOs are not pushed aside by national government feeling that since it has the word national in it, I'm the Ministry of Health and I'm going to take over this. And the second very important point, as you try to then, but the work, as I was mentioning earlier, it needs to happen in the country, the persuasion. Because now we've got the guidelines out there. We say that those community system strengthening interventions are welcome, and the guidelines are very broad. The actual convincing has to happen in the country. And one of the key things you need to realize is the HIV world, at least the TB and malaria worlds have been there for a while, is making just small baby steps, aside from treatment literacy and ARTA education and some peer support groups, and some aspects of community home-based care. The HIV world is so new and has been so closed in and on itself, it has not learned from, I think, decades, if not centuries, of the work that MNCH, community-based work, has already done. Bring these strengths, don't be shy about them, I would say, at the country level, and let's work with policymakers and secretariat to change the minds of people that to codify community system strengthening, to realize its resource needs and how differently it needs to be dealt with. It's really very important, so I would suggest that that's a very important action point. Thank you.
The hordes are going to come through the door in just a second. One more question, but we want to carry this out further. You did have your hand up first, we're going to move for those who want to take the dialogue more, especially with regard to next steps. We're going to try to commandeer some seats or list a little area out in one of the hallways here, because I think this is an opportunity that I'm not sure we'll be able to replicate anytime real soon. So can you ask your question real quick, and then we can move out on out.
Look at the countries that have succeeded in reducing infant or maternal mortality related to these specific issues. What three or four characteristics do they have that stand out that can be perhaps reproduced?
Yeah.
For me, I'd like the colleagues to also comment because they're more knowledgeable about that. For me, the country examples I gave, we didn't really do an analysis, but they're all countries where at that particular point in time, there was a strong visionary in the CCM or in the Ministry of Health that recognized the benefit of designing the response to the three diseases in a way where it has a bigger impact. So these are the ones that taught us. Later on, the Ethiopian minister became chairman of the board, and he's one of those who initiated the push towards the Global Fund addressing that. And at that time, he didn't succeed, but we're now listening to these champions and believers from that point. But it could be other things as well.
I think I'd like to just comment on Zambia, which was one of the examples where they've actually reduced some of the levels of increased the IPTP2 uptake at the levels of 60%. And the reason we found in the case study analysis that we did was that there was a much better dialogue and partnership. The Ministry of Health, Reproductive Health, and the Malaria Control Program sat jointly together to make sure that SPD is available and how we're going to distribute it at the antenatal care level. And that dialogue went all the way from the national level to the district level. So it was, many levels of that dialogue continue. And there was that history with, for a long time. They had the policies, but they also had to continue engagement with each other to make sure that it happened.
I don't want to repeat my word, but I'm Sudanese. And seeing the slides that Anne put up there for maternal mortality, which was much better in the 60s and 70s, despite female genital mutilation being highly prevalent, I'm really ashamed. What's the Ministry of Health's response to it? They're about to abolish the Ministry of Health next week in a cabinet reshuffle. We're going backwards in France. We have no champions for health in Sudan. Mm. The means are there, the money used, the country used to swim in oil, and the oil money, and the priorities are going elsewhere. And we have an excess of health workers. We're not one of the 57 crisis countries for a health workforce, reasonably trained, I guess.
Well, I hope we whetted your appetite. We're going to try to find a place out there. Again, we're going to be focusing on them getting to know each other, and for those of you who are here and you know who you are, who would like to continue this, this is just the first step. Thank you very much, and thank you.
Thank you.
This is perfect.
Thank you.